This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Over the holidays, we've been featuring a few of the interviews from 2020 that we enjoyed. We'll start today with my conversation with NPR's longtime legal correspondent, Nina Totenberg. We talked about her friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we talked about Nina's life and career. She's been covering the Supreme Court since 1969 and is widely considered the dean of legal journalists. Nina became NPR's legal correspondent in 1975. She's reported on major shifts in the court over the decades and has broken major stories about the court. In 1987, after Ronald Reagan nominated Douglas Ginsburg to serve on the Supreme Court, Nina reported that he'd smoked marijuana in the past, which the Republican base did not approve of, and which was still illegal. After her report, Ginsburg asked Reagan to withdraw his nomination. In 1991, during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, just a couple of days before the scheduled vote, before Anita Hill's name was even mentioned in the hearings, Nina reported that she got a copy of the affidavit Hill had filed with the Judiciary Committee alleging Thomas had sexually harassed her. Nina read from the affidavit on the air. That led the vote on Thomas to be postponed so that Hill could testify publicly at the hearings. I spoke with Nina Totenberg in October at a Zoom event that was a benefit for WHYY, where Fresh Air is produced. So let's talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is a very close friend of yours. And, you know, she dictated a letter to her granddaughter when she was dying, when she knew she was dying, saying that, you know, that her final wish was that, you know, nobody appoint her replacement until after the inauguration.
Right.
And, of course, that was, you know, ignored by President Trump, but... did she have serious regrets? Can you say if she had serious regrets about not having retired early in, you know, earlier in the Obama presidency, earlier than the final year of his presidency when his Merrick Garland appointment was blocked?
You know, Ruth didn't do regrets, and she didn't do defeat. She just soldiered on. And I don't think that she regretted that Trump was president. I think that's patently obvious from some of the impolitic things that she said and shouldn't have said, on one occasion anyway. But that's just not the way she operated. She operated to live and to get her work done. And she did that almost until the day she died. Not quite, but I'd say within weeks. I don't think she even acknowledged the possibility of really dying before a new president, whether it would be Trump or Biden, was sworn in. I don't think she really acknowledged that genuine possibility that she was going to die before then until maybe a couple of weeks before she died.
You became friends with her in 1971 when she was writing the famous brief that got women included in the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. So you befriended her. First, she was like a source for you, and I think she was still a professor then.
Right, she was a professor at Rutgers then.
Yeah, and so you bonded with her over this incredibly consequential women's rights decision.
I called her up because I was brand new covering the court. I was in my early 20s. I didn't really understand this brief, so I did what I always do. I ask questions like you do. And so I called her up. I flipped to the front of the brief. The author was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The telephone number was on the cover of the brief. I called the telephone number. She picked up the phone and she gave me an hour-long lecture. And it was the beginning of what would ultimately be a very long friendship. Initially, it was just a professional friendship. And then when she moved to Washington, we became really close friends. And she, you know, she was a very interesting person and in a way difficult to peg in the sense that a lot of people took her for being a bit austere, because in fact she was very shy and very quiet. So when you would have her over to dinner, you sometimes really had to strain to hear her voice. And what could you discuss with her? After all, you can't discuss the court, what's going on at the court. But in fact, we had just many wonderful times together. And especially in the last year of her life, when she, during lockdown, she came to our house for dinner on Saturday nights, every Saturday night, almost until the time she died. We went away on vacation. We came back. She was really not feeling well, and we brought dinner to her. And that was the last time I saw her. It was probably about 10 days before she died. But I did talk to her. I said goodbye to her on the phone.
How did you find the words of how to say it, especially somebody who never wanted to acknowledge that she might be near death?
Well, at that point, it was just a couple of days before she died, and she couldn't talk anymore. But her daughter said she raised her hand to wave, sort of, the amazing thing about Ruth was, and I keep finding this out from, you think you're special because she's done so many very specially kind things, not having to do with my profession at all, for me. So when my late husband, when he was, you know, he had a very serious head injury, he fell and hit his head. And for almost 5 years, well, first for almost the better part of a year, he was in the ICU. And she gave me the best advice, anybody's life advice anybody ever gave me. She said, you can't stay at the hospital all the time. There's no point in doing that. You go to work. You visit him for an hour a day or something like that. You know, he was on a respirator. He had a tube in his. So she said, you do what you, and then you go to work. She said, it won't be your best work, but it will be good work anyway. And when he comes home, you will be prepared to take care of him the way you'll have to take care of him when he comes home. Because you will still be you. You won't be lost to the bowels, essentially, of hospital life. You will be your own self, and you'll be able to take care of him. And she was so spot on. It was such an amazing piece of advice. And, you know, he came home. He did get better, but he was incredibly frail for the remainder of his life. And there were a bunch of, you know, emergencies frequently. And she knew every time he was in the hospital or something happened, she would just scoop me up and take me somewhere with Marty, you know, for a dinner or to have dinner at their apartment with somebody interesting or to the opera, just to take my mind off of things.
I want to ask you another question about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and your friendship with her. How did you manage to maintain the friendship and report on her at the same time? What kind of guidelines did you set for each other about where the boundaries would be so that you could continue to be friends without jeopardizing, you know, your reporting?
Well, you know, we never had a per se discussion about it, but it was absolutely clear I couldn't ask her about things going on behind the scenes at the court. She wouldn't have told me, and she probably would have considered it really untoward. By the same token, I couldn't trim my sails when I was interviewing her. So after she made those unfortunate comments about Trump, I'd had an interview scheduled with her. And over time, I learned that the best practice with Ruth was to tell her what you were going to ask her that was new and different than things you'd asked her before when you were doing a big interview with her. Because if you just asked her, she would clam up. Whereas if you told her in advance, she would think about it. So in that case, I said, look, I'm going to ask you about what you said about Trump. And she said, oh, please don't do that. I said, Ruth, I can't do that. you have your job, I have mine. And she said, okay. And then she reamed me out in the interview.
wait, I don't remember. What did she say?
She said, I've apologized and I've issued a statement and I shouldn't have said it. And I said, but what did you mean? I did a follow-up question and she said, I've told you what I have said and that I have apologized and I am not going to discuss it further.
I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the history that you've covered and how you've affected that history. So let's talk a little bit about the Clarence Thomas hearings and Anita Hill. So, you know, you had learned that she had submitted an affidavit to the Judiciary Committee and that, well, basically it was ignored. I mean, mm-hmm. It did not become part of the public hearings.
It's true that it was ignored, but it's also true that she really didn't want her name to be public.
Right.
And so, when I talked to her at first, she didn't want her name to be public still. And I said, I was trying to get her to do an interview with me. And she said that she, if I could get the affidavit, that she would agree to an interview. And I think, having read Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson's book, that, and also from my own sort of gut, is that she didn't really think I could get the affidavit and that therefore she would not have to come forward. But I did get the affidavit and she lived up to what she'd said. She did do an interview with me. And there's almost everything that she said in the hearing, she said in that interview. And I, you know, when I broke that story, I thought that there was a 50-50 chance it would just die. Because if she sort of left her house and was unreachable and didn't talk to anybody else in the news media, it would have died without a human face. And she didn't do that. She was very young at the time. She was in her 20s. And she had no, you know, I thought it was incredibly, what she did was very brave.
Can you tell us anything about how you got the affidavit?
No.
Okay, I thought.
Even my husband doesn't know.
Really? Was Anita Hill really angry with you for finding the affidavit, reading it on the air, and basically requiring her, therefore, to go public since she didn't want to? And her life has been forever changed. But also, I hope she takes some comfort in knowing how she affected the public understanding of sexual harassment. But was she angry with you?
This is a two-part answer. So I waited over 24 hours before I did the story. I even did an interview with her, before we broadcast the story, because I kept trying to get hold of Joe Biden for comment. And I did everything in my power to reach him, and I failed. And finally, we just said, well, just, you know, you would never do that. You would never hold that kind of a story today. It's almost inconceivable that you would hold it for over 24 hours. But we did. And it cost us a bit because somebody else got part of the story, but didn't have the affidavit or, you know, and so we had to share some of the, quote, glory and also some of the awful repercussions from it. But so I did the story all as a piece. So I got the affidavit, I called her, we did the interview, and then we did the story. We broadcast the story like about 24 hours later. So what, but the question is a good one. Was she angry with me? And I think she was, but this is only an inference. I've written to her a couple of times. After the hearings, and then again another time, and I have never received a reply, and she's given plenty of interviews to other people over time, and I think to, and even to NPR, but not me. So I take it from that she was not happy with me. And I think that, you know, this is not an this is a sort of human reaction to somebody who turned her life upside down. And that she probably has a bunch of ideas about things I did. I remember there were a couple of things which I can't remember in Jane and Jill's book, which I, you know, were not her, which were her, clearly her perceptions, and in mine were not accurate. But it's not of great import to me. I'm sorry she's angry. I have a lot of respect for her. And I think as a, her role in the Me Too movement has been very significant.
What was it like for you to be the reporter who broke the story of having the affidavit and being actually able to read it, quote from it? It was like the Anita Hill hearings were so controversial, and she was so smeared. And of course, she was angry with you. And I'm sure a lot of people were angry with you.
Everybody was angry with me. The Democrats were angry with me. Uh-huh. Biden was angry with me. The majority leader, Senator Mitchell, was angry with me because I'd, you know, they were really fearful about a sexually charged allegation. And remember, this is 1991, against a black nominee. This was a powder keg. And to this day, when I watch any video of that hearing, and you watch either of these two people, Clarence Thomas or Anita Hill, you can believe either one. I don't think you can believe both. There's not a way to do that.
You mean you have to believe one or the other?
You have to believe one or the other. And so the Democrats were not pleased. I'd really made life very difficult for them. They were caught between what, you know, the faxes were basically vaporizing from women who were coming out of the woodwork and were enraged by the fact that the Judiciary Committee hadn't investigated this. And they knew that women voters were their constituency. At the same time, so were black voters their constituency. This was a no-win proposition in their view. And then, meanwhile, the Republicans are wanting to kill me. And, I mean, I remember interviewing live on, because we did we covered the hearings, both the first hearings and the second hearings, live jointly, NPR and PBS. And I remember Senator Jack Danforth sitting next to me as I'm interviewing him with Paul Duke. And I swear, what went through my mind was he would like to eat me up for breakfast. He would like to just chomp me, spit me out, and make me go away forever. And, you know, I had a kind of an infamous contretemps with Senator Alan Simpson the night I was on Nightline after I broke the story. We ultimately became friends because it is not in my interest to have members of the United States Senate, especially the Judiciary Committee, which I cover and covered, furious with me for the rest of their lives because it interferes with my ability to do my job.
So did you approach him to change the relationship?
Well, eventually I did. I invited him to go to the radio and TV correspondence dinner with me. His press guy then leaked it, but he arrived to pick me up for that dinner. He even brought me a corsage. He was in it, you know, we were definitely the stars of that evening.
I remember. So what kind of body armor did you develop when you were under attack and everybody on all sides, you say, was hating you?
Well, you know, I tell this story about because it's true and because it's funny and because it sort of captures everything. So the night after I broke the story on a Sunday morning. And a Monday night, I did Nightline, and Simpson was on, and the late Paul Simon, senator from Illinois, was on, and I was on. And you know, I have thanked God many times that I was not a 20-something at the time, because if I had been, I would have been really, I think, unable to maintain my, the demeanor I had to maintain. So that night, at the end of the show, and Alan Simpson was saying that I was a completely unethical journalist and I'd broken all kinds of ethical codes and et cetera, et cetera. And so I waited till about 50 seconds before the end of the show. And I got the floor and I said, look, if I hadn't reported this story, it never would have come out. And if the Senate Judiciary Committee had done its job and investigated these charges, I never would have had this story. So I head out. They had sent a car for me. I head out. I get in the car. Al Simpson, who's about 6'8", comes dashing out after me, holds the door open, and is yelling at me. And I finally, after about 3 or 4 minutes of this, and I couldn't close the door, I got out. I stood up to my full then 5 feet 4.5 inches, and I said, Senator, you are a blankety-blank bully, and you can figure out what the blankety-blanks were. I got back in the car. We drove off. I said to the guy, the driver, I said, go. I pulled the door shut. We go out. He turns around the corner. There's more to this story. And he says to me, he pulls over. He says, lady, you better get a gun. I go home. My husband, who is a former United States senator, the late wonderful Floyd Haskell, had not been watching this because it was a Monday night football night. So he just went to bed. And some husbandly instinct, I walk in the house, and he comes down the stairs, and he's standing at the top of the stairs in his PJs, and he said to me, what's wrong? And I said, Alan Simpson yelled at me, and I told him I used a bad word, and I just completely, I totally lost it. I mean, I just cried and cried and cried.
Thank you, Nina. I want to say again how generous it's been of you to spend some time with us. And Nina, I just want to give you my personal thanks for being such an important woman in journalism who has had an effect on other journalists like me, other women journalists. So thank you for that, too.
Thank you, Terry.
Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Our interview was recorded at a Zoom event in October that was a benefit for WHYY, where Fresh Air is produced. This year's Emmy for Best Limited TV Series went to HBO's Watchmen. My next guest, Cord Jefferson, was one of the series writers. He won an Emmy for writing Episode 6. Watchmen is based on the graphic novel of the same name and combines elements of superhero comics, sci-fi, and time travel, and the all-too-true trauma of racism in the U.S. In the series, in 2016, a white supremacist group attacked the homes of 40 police officers working for the Tulsa Police Department. Of those who survived, only two stayed with the force, a black cop, Detective Angela Abar, played by Regina King, and a white cop, Police Chief Judd Crawford, played by Don Johnson. To protect themselves, the police decide to conceal their identities by wearing masks. In the episode that Jefferson won an Emmy for writing, Angela time travels back to her grandfather's childhood in Tulsa, where he survived the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, when mobs of white residents were given weapons by city officials and attacked black people and businesses. The attack destroyed more than 35 square blocks of a prosperous black community known as Black Wall Street. We also see how the grandfather went on to become a police officer in the 1930s, who faced brutality from white supremacists, some of whom were his fellow cops. To fight back against white supremacists while hiding his identity, he wears a black hood and becomes known as Hooded Justice. Cord Jefferson has also written for the series Succession, The Good Place, Master of None, and Larry Wilmore's political satire series The Nightly Show.
Jefferson also wrote for the now-defunct website Gawker, where he was the site's West Coast editor. Cord Jefferson, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start with the Tulsa Massacre, which is kind of central to the whole story in this. How did it become a central part of the series? I don't think it's in the graphic novel that it's based on.
It is not anywhere in the graphic novel. That idea came to us via Damon Lindelof, the creator of the show. He came into the room on day one and said that he wanted the Tulsa Massacre to be a part of the show in some way. He said that he had read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Case for Reparations in the Atlantic cover story and was really moved by it. And he had never heard about the Tulsa Massacre until he read that. And he was really moved by the story and wanted to include it somehow in the show. So he came into the room saying he wanted to use it, but how we were actually going to incorporate it, we didn't know. I think it took us about a month or two to decide that not only was it going to be in the pilot, but it was going to open the series and that we would begin on the Tulsa Massacre. And I'm really happy that we decided to include it there and not somewhere else.
You could say it's hard to be shocked by anything in terms of the racist aspect of America's history. On the other hand, was there something about the Tulsa Massacre that you found particularly shocking?
So a friend said to me that the thing that really made them think that it was all made up when they watched the first episode was the planes firebombing the buildings. They said that that seemed ridiculous or you know, a fanciful imagination came up with that for a shocking scene in a pilot. And I think that to me was shocking when I read about it, is that they were sending out planes to firebomb these buildings. Like I think the viciousness and the violence with which all of this was enacted was shocking to me.
I wonder if writing this series made you think a lot about generational trauma, how trauma is kind of passed on to succeeding generations.
Absolutely. I think it was one of the most important themes to me in the series, and it was incredibly important to me personally, too. I was you know, thrilled that we were putting it in there.
Is this something you thought about a lot before?
Yeah. My father is a Vietnam veteran, and he is I think that he would tell you himself that he did not and was not given the resources necessary to deal with the sort of emotional and mental injuries that he suffered over there, if not physical. And I have spent a lot of time in my adult life trying to figure out the ways in which my dad influenced me and affected the way that I behave. And I think that I'm only, you know, I'm in my late 30s and I'm only now really reaching conclusions about how exactly my dad's time in Vietnam when he was, you know, 22 years old have affected me 50 years later. And I think that for me, when I was working on this show, but particularly working on episode 6, which is, I think, deals most directly with the generational trauma, I think that I was drawing on some of the issues that I deal with personally when I was working on it. Yeah.
So the character who is the superhero in this, who is also the character who is the cop in the 1930s and who survived the Tulsa Massacre, he becomes known as Hooded Justice. He takes the hood that was used when he was being lynched, and this is going to be complicated, but fellow cops who were white supremacists lynched him with a black hood over him and then cut him down and basically said, next time, we're not going to cut you down. He takes that hood and uses it to disguise himself to fight white supremacists. So it's an interesting twist on the superhero origin story. Do you want to talk about the process of coming up with that?
Yeah.
And maybe you'd want to explain it a little better than I did.
Yeah, well, I'll try. It is complicated. But So Hooded Justice is a character in the original text of Watchmen. He's not a big character by any means, but he is the original superhero. He is the one that all the other masked vigilantes modeled themselves after. And his identity is never discovered. It's theorized in the book that he is this German bodybuilder because he's said to be sort of hulking and strong, but nobody really knows if that's the case. And one day he just disappears. And so it's this mystery that's left unsolved in the text. And so when we came into the room, Damon said that another thing that he knew besides wanting to include Tulsa and the Tulsa massacre was he wanted Hood of Justice to be a black man. And who that black man was going to be, we didn't know, and we worked backwards from there. One of the things that is also in the original text is that Hood of Justice, his costume is this black mass, and he has a noose around his neck also. That's part of his getup. And so Damon's a big fan of homework in the room, and one day the homework for the writers was, it was a while ago at this point, but I believe the homework was come in with a reason why Hood of Justice has a noose around his neck. And I came in the next morning and pitched the idea that, you know, if we're saying that this is a black character and we're saying this black character goes around with a noose around his neck, to me, that signifies somebody who has lived through some sort of racial violence and probably a lynching. And so I came in and pitched the story that he would, Will Reeves, as a police officer, would have gone out and attempted to arrest a wealthy white man in the community, and that white man would be upset, and he would be part of some white supremacist organization, and that he would convince his fellow white supremacists, who were also police officers, to exact some justice on his revenge by threatening Will Reeves the next day with a lynching, and that they would cut him down midway and just it would serve as a warning. That was the origin story for how that scene came to be. I think some people were surprised by the revelation that Hood of Justice was a black man in the show's telling of Watchmen, but for me, the more I thought about it, the more I thought that it made perfect sense for a black person to be the first superhero. I mean, the superheroes in most tellings are these people who cannot find justice via traditional means, and so they need to find justice via extrajudicial means. And so if we're saying that that is somebody in the 1930s, I think the person who would be most likely to not be able to find justice and to have to go outside of the traditional system in order to find the justice that they need would be a black person. It just made perfect sense.
Were there any personal experiences you drew on in writing the series?
Yeah, I think that this is that sort of anger that Angela feels, and that sort of just barely beneath the surface rage that she feels due in no small part to the traumas that were enacted on her ancestors 100 years ago. That is something that I felt deeply. I think that I personally deal with a lot of anger. Anger's always been one of my issues, and I've done a lot of anger management therapy in my life. And I think that figuring out the origin of that anger and understanding that some of that anger extends back decades before I was even born, and understanding that anger comes from a place that is sort of outside of you sometimes was, I think, hugely beneficial for me when I was thinking about this story and thinking about what we wanted to do with the show.
You've talked about how you feel like you inherited some of your father's experiences and trauma from the war in Vietnam. Are there other things that you think made you so affected by fear and pain that expressed itself as anger?
Yeah, I think that, you know, my family spent some time overseas when I was younger, but by the time I was 5 or 6, we had moved back to Tucson, and that's where I spent the rest of my childhood. And Tucson is pretty homogenous. There is a lot of Latinos there, but outside of whites and Latinos, there isn't a lot of diversity. There's certainly not a lot of black people in Tucson. And so I was kind of a black kid with a funny name who had like a funny backstory that my family had lived overseas. And so I felt kind of like an outsider. Well, not kind of like, I felt very much like an outsider during much of my childhood, although I don't think that I really understood that And then when I graduated, went to college, I went to college at a small school in Virginia called William & Mary that great academically. And my dad had, there's some history there where my dad, the Black Law Students Association at William & Mary is named after my father because he had gone there for law school and he was, I think, the first student accepted there, which is why they named the society after him. And so he was a big advocate for me going there, and I decided to go, and I got there, and, you know, it was even more homogenous than Tucson had been, and there was not a lot of ethnic diversity whatsoever, and it was also around, I think I was around really sort of wealthy people for the first time. You know, Tucson has rich people, but college was the first time I was around real sort of old money East Coast people, and that made me feel like even more of an outsider. And I think that, and I was also in the South, which I had not experienced before, and seeing Confederate flags, and it was just a sort of toxic stew of me feeling very lonely and very isolated and like I wasn't understood. And I think that, you know, not to put my problems on all externalities, a lot of that was my own issues. And I think that a thing that I had learned from my dad that he and I are talking about a lot nowadays is to not really express your emotions, and that I think a thing that a lot of Black men in this country and Black women for that matter in this country are burdened with is the idea that sharing emotion is a sign of weakness, and that in order to get by in this country and to be respected and treated fairly, you need to be strong, and you need to advocate for yourself, and you need to stand up straight and hold your head high and not people see vulnerability in order to succeed. And I remember my dad telling me that when I was a kid that if I wanted to be as successful as white people, then I needed to do two for every white man's one, and that I needed to be twice as good to have as much success as a white person. And so I just felt like there was a lot on my shoulders that I needed to carry that I wasn't necessarily probably prepared to carry by myself. And I felt like I needed to do it all alone.
In 2014, you wrote a piece about your mother and her diagnosis of a type of breast cancer that's very aggressive and very difficult to treat. And I regret to say she died in 2016. I was sorry to hear that when we Thanks. Talked earlier. And you write a little bit about her history in that piece, and about how it sounds like her mother suffered with a very severe undiagnosed depression. If we're talking about generational trauma.
Absolutely. Well, my mom had a difficult childhood too, so that is absolutely part of it.
Yeah. And your mother is white, and your father is Black, and when your mother started dating him, your grandfather on your mother's side was really angry. And I think when you were born, he refused to see her anymore because you were Black.
Yeah, he disowned her. He disowned her before that. He disowned her when they started dating. When my parents started dating, my dad was my mom's divorce lawyer. So my mother had been married right out of college to her first husband, who was white. And my dad was consummate professional. He sort of finished her divorce proceedings, and she left his office. And by the time she got home, there was a message on her answering machine from him saying, now that we are no longer working together, now that you're no longer a client, I was wondering if you'd go out to dinner with me. And so they started dating shortly thereafter, and her father disowned her because of it. And then he refused to meet me after I was born. I would send him letters and he would return them. But when they started dating, he said, I never want to see you ever again. And my mother, I think it was shortly before Christmas, and she went out and bought him and her stepmother some gifts and brought them to his house and left them on the doorstep. And when she came home later that day, the gifts were on her doorstep, and there was a note that said, when I said never, I meant never. And then he meant never. So I would send him, I would send him letters a couple times a year until I was about 8 or 9, and he would always send them back. So I never got to meet him. I think the last time that my mother saw him on his deathbed. She saw him right before he died. But that was it. But there's this sort of really haunting she had a reconciliation with her brother shortly before she died, I would say about 2 or 3 years before she was diagnosed, who had sort of, she'd also had a falling out with because of all this turmoil with her dad. And he told her that one day before their dad passed, he had walked into a room and seen her father with a box of letters that she had sent him over the years reading them. And so he was, it's sort of this really haunting, tragic story. You can, you know that ultimately he was thinking about her and wanted to reach out, but something in him just wasn't allowing him to do it. I guess this, the hate ran so deep that it prevented him from doing it. But I have no idea what they said to each other on his deathbed, but I know that she flew back to Ohio to see him.
You know, you've talked about carrying around a lot of anger over the years, and I can only imagine how angry you would be when your own grandfather refused to even meet you because you were black.
Yeah. People think that the things that happen are just part of their lives. You don't really think of how it affects you at the time. You think that this is something that just happened and I've dealt with it and now it's over. And so for years and years and years, I just thought of this as just, that's my backstory. That's sort of, it's not a huge deal. I don't, there's nothing sort of, I think, in intellectually that I'm missing by never having met my grandfather. And yet at the same time, I understand that deep down there probably is something. There probably is a longing there. There probably is a desire to feel loved by your family and to want to know them and to want them to know you. But it wasn't something that I thought of really intellectually until recently. But absolutely, yeah, I think that that's part of it. You know, and I think that some of that anger is directed at them, not for my own sake, but because I saw how much it hurt my mother. It devastated her. It was, it really, really, really hurt her for her entire life.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing not to get the love that you want from a relative. It's another thing to be completely rejected and making a conscious decision to never even meet you. I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I was lucky I was raised in a home full of love. My dad and my mother had their own issues, but they never made me feel unloved. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was crucial because, you know, I think that I remember asking him what was wrong with me that my grandfather didn't like. I remember that is, you know, when he sent back the letters, I would ask my mom, you know, why doesn't he like me? And she would explain, it has nothing to do with you. He doesn't know you. He is I can't remember the term that she used, but she would make sure to explain to me that it was not anything that I did, that I was totally innocent in the matter. And I think that, you know, that was incredibly important for me because, yeah, otherwise, if you don't have that reassurance, I think that I could have gone in a totally different direction.
Yeah. Well, one of your personal essays is about how you donated a kidney to your father in 2009 when your father was living in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. I've asked myself, what would I do in a situation like that? And I don't know. Did he ask you, or did you just volunteer?
I volunteered initially, but he rejected it initially. He even explored buying one. And so eventually he came to my brothers and I and asked if we would be willing to donate. And my brothers both have families, and I luckily, I didn't have a family and I had a job that allowed me to travel. So I was the best match, and I went to Saudi Arabia for about 3.5 months and went through with the donation. He'd given me life. He had supported me my entire life. And so it felt like this organ was partly his. This kidney was partly his. And so I was happy to give it.
In your essay about your mother and her cancer diagnosis, you write, "The world takes from us relentlessly. It takes our friends and first loves. It takes our parents. It takes our faith. It takes our dignity. It takes our passion. It takes our health. It takes our honesty and it takes our credulity. To lose so much and still hold on to yourself is perhaps the most complicated task human beings are asked to perform." And, you know, reading that now during the COVID pandemic, I think that just has a very special resonance now. And I'm wondering what the pandemic has been like for you so far. How you're finding a way to get by and you know, how you're dealing with anxiety and fear while also trying to do your work, how vulnerable you do or don't feel.
Yeah. I mean, I feel incredibly grateful. I have been employed doing a job that I enjoy. And I know that there are so many people who have lost their work during these times. I think that the way that I've worked through it is I just try to stay focused on my work. I try to donate money and time and resources in places that they're required. And I go to a lot of therapy. I go to a whole lot of therapy. That's also been helping me.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I've loved it. Thank you.
Cord Jefferson was a writer on the HBO limited series Watchmen. He won an Emmy for writing episode 6 of the series. We recorded our interview in August of 2020.